Hello there. Welcome to Rome FM. Here we dive into the minds, workflows, and machinations of the Rome cult, the believers of Rome research. My name is Norman Cella, and I am on a mission to deconstruct wisdom from all walks of life so we can understand each other better. In this episode, we talk with Sam Marfleet, who is a writer, a marketer, and currently writing a study guide to the famous work, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Hailing from Trinidad and Tobago, he discovered Rome in early 2020, which had answers to a question he's had in a very long time. How can he remember all of these stacks of notebooks that he's had written and forgotten because it is just too difficult to recall all of the written information? So having one giant commonplace for all of these things, one giant Rome graph, had allowed him to thrive and make the most of his note-taking. As someone fascinated with storytelling, writing, and symbolism, Sam had embarked on a very interesting project, a study guide for the famous work by Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, to explore the meaning of a story. What is a story? So, in this episode, we'll be talking about how he's discovered the tool Rome Research and how that has made a huge impact on what he's doing right now. And diving right into The Hero of a Thousand Faces, we talk about why the story is a very interesting concept to Sam, the different relationship with books in the public intellectual space, or why we have a tendency to measure the number of books read, an exploration of the study guide as a format. It's how Sam is providing readers their own set of tools to have their own experiences of the book Hero of a Thousand Faces, aka supplemental material to help with reading said material. The implications of Joseph Campbell's works on mythologies, the stories that we tell, and the psychological challenges that are manifested as symbolic characters that we see a lot in stories all the way up until today, and epistemology, diving into the empirical truth of stories, the metaphysical. What does it mean for a story to be true? What does it mean to have a story influence every aspect of our lives, ethics, society, influence, and more? Sam shares his thoughts after reading this book three times to realize the truths that he holds dear to his heart. And a public mythology graph. We shoot ideas against each other on what a graph talking about humanity's stories would look like, what is needed, what kind of people would be involved in the creation of this graph, and much more. So I highly recommend that you slow down your listening speed when you are taking in this episode, because we are going to dive into some amazingly deep truths about The Hero of a Thousand Faces. So without further ado, let's dive into my chat with Sam Marfleet. Mr. Sam Marfleet, welcome to Rome FM. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
No worries. I'm happy that we get to talk in the wee hours of the morning, at least morning for me, so that I can energize myself with this amazing conversation surrounding Rome. And I like how you're using it. I really, really like how you're using it. The fact that we're going to talk about the hero's journey and Joseph Campbell and anything related to that, because I am a big fan of narratives and I'm a big fan of mythology. So for you to marry Rome and that, put that together is something really, really fascinating. But let's just save that a little bit for later, because there has to be a reason why you're obsessed with it or why you have an interest in mythology or showcasing all of this through Rome. So could you tell me, Sam, about the dark times before you stumbled into Rome? What were you up to? What were you doing? And how did you discover the tool?
Ah, life before Rome. Was there ever such a thing? great question. So, there's two parts to that, which is why mythology and why Rome? So I guess I'll start with Rome. I remember when I first discovered Rome, I had this strong sense that I had stumbled upon the answer to a question that I had been carrying with me for a very long time. And the image that I have in mind is that I was finishing up university or college, as the Americans say, and I was looking at stacks and stacks of notebooks, and this sort of somber, desperate realization came over me when I thought, I'm going to forget 90% of this, and I'm never going to open these notebooks ever again. And honestly, that kind of broke my heart because I had put in a lot of work, and the idea, I wasn't satisfied with the idea that those concepts would just be floating around somewhere in my subconscious untapped. I really felt like it was a grave loss that I couldn't put them to any better use. And so when Rome was explained to me as a way to resurface my knowledge and to document one hub for all of my documentation, I just thought, well, hell, I'm already doing the documentation. I'm already taking copious amounts of notes because that's how I understand things. The idea that I would have a commonplace book or a single place to record all of these things and resurface them whenever I'm ready to write, because I write all the time, or whenever I'm ready to think about things, which I do on paper most of the time, that was just mind-blowing. And so that discovery was early in 2020, and I am an avid user of Rome ever since. I am not a power user. I'm the simplest, like I use the basic functionality, but what I will say for myself is I do almost all of my work in Rome, like CRM, like personal management, like day-to-day task management, project management, pretty much anything that doesn't involve like serious multiplayer collaboration, because, well, we could sort of sidebar why that might be, but like long story short is, you know, the freeform nature of Rome would require that if you have multiple people working on it, you need to in advance decide on some sort of syntax, a language that you operate. Otherwise two people, you know, it's freeform enough that you can go haywire really quickly. Yeah. So yeah, that's the reason why I got into Rome. And that's what I do with Rome every day. And functionally what that looks like is my outputs are, I write a blog. I occasionally, when I'm invited, come on and do podcasts with interesting people like yourself. And I am using it as a platform to explore the art of the study guide. Which is what brings us to the hero with 1,000 faces. So if you want, I can jump straight into why mythology, or we can talk more about Rome. What do you think?
Oh, why mythology? There has to be there because you have, I feel like you've got all your uses covered by just this one tool, which sounds fascinating. Of course, I'm going to ask about the workflow. But parallel to that is your willingness to do the study guide for Hero of 1,000 Faces, your willingness to dive into the field of mythology. So Sam, why mythology?
How do you ask that? On a practical level, it was, I believe that to learn anything, you need a tangible project, you need an output. And so the Hero with 1,000 Faces, developing a study guide was a way for me to actually learn Rome. It's no sense learning a language, and I think Rome is a language, without a concrete project. But then as to why I picked the Hero with 1,000 Faces, well, you know, that's because I am by trade a marketer. You know, I traffic in stories. This is what we do. But I also, you know, as long as I can remember, have been fascinated with storytelling, with writing, with symbolism, and with just the means by which human beings communicate mission critical information from one person to another. And so the story is an interesting concept. You know, we don't often stop to think about what is a story, but like on a functional level, you know, a story is a format or a framework for ideas that makes them stickier, that helps them pass down through generations. And so if you start to think of it like that, you know, let's say we are in a pre-writing civilization and you have learned some hard-won lessons that maybe cost you a family member or cost you dearly, you know, not to be so melodramatic, you know, a story, enshrining those lessons in a story was basically the number one way that we can ensure that your descendants and your descendants' descendants learn from these lessons, that they kept them, especially in an era where the recorded knowledge oftentimes, you know, died with its biological carrier. And so this is, you know, this is sort of the basis of my fascination with stories. And I think to go even further, you know, there's an aspect to this that's not just about storytelling. I have a different, I think a slightly different relationship with books to the one that I see often on Twitter and just basically on the collective, public intellectual life. Right. I see a lot of, there's a lot of buzz around reading a wide variety of books or reading many books or counting the amount of books that you've read in a year. And while I think I support anything that involves people reading, you know, my mother always told me I was the person that thought that he could teach himself anything from a book. I, you know, 100% support that. I also think at the same time that the way people often speed through these great works does themselves a disservice. And I think that most people are not, I would hazard to guess that most people are not really giving their great works and their great books the amount of attention they need to really extract all of the goodness inside of them.
Right.
My famous example is The Art of War. You know, everybody's got a copy of The Art of War on their shelves, but like, how many can really say that they understand the messages and use the messages in that book? You know, how many people can say that they reference it often? How many people can say that it really impacts their lives? And I think that the answer is not many. And I think that this comes from reading for reading's sake, as opposed to reading to change your life. And my belief is that like a good book definitely should change your life. Otherwise, like, what's the point, man? I mean, besides reading for fun, which has its own benefits. So this is why, this is why both the background in mythology and the belief that we should be getting more out of our books led me to want to create this study guide to The Hero with 1,000 Faces, which is, you know, the classic book on mythology. It is quite a dense book. It's difficult to get through. It was really difficult for me to get through. I bounced off of it like two or three times. And I just thought, okay, I've got this software here. I've got this interest in storytelling. And I've got this belief that like a person should basically meditate on a book until it changes their lives. How can I knit all three together? And how can I do it in public so that not only is this my own private endeavor, but this basically sends a signal to the world, to people like you that like, hey, I'm out here. I'm a little lonely in my intellectual pursuits. This is what I'm into. I'm putting in the work and basically saying, hey, I put my blood and sweat in. So I'm not just opining, like I'm actually working on a project. So if you want to talk to me about this, like, come on over. Like, this is my signal to say, hey. So those were the motivations.
Like a lighthouse to attract other people who know about the struggles of not only researching such a dense piece of information, because The Hero of 1,000 Faces, like you said, it is a well-known piece of work, but it's referenced many times, though never fully articulated or simplified enough that it can be applied. Because there's a difference between applying it and referencing it. And I like that you chose The Hero of 1,000 Faces for this. And I'm not one to... So I'm not really familiar... I'm going to be very honest. I'm not really familiar with the format of the study guide. And I think... I mean, I could totally ask you, like, what is your definition of a study guide? Is there certain practices around it? But even before that, there is something that I do want to bring up from what you just said just now. I think there is a certain... I feel like it's like trophy hunting when you start to measure objectively the number of books you've read as a number, as a digit, to measure one's ability to grow. It's like leveling up in a game, Like if you play Mario and you'll level up from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, that is a sign of progress. And it's like the most imprinted, embedded version of one's ability to grow. So it's like evidence that you've gone from one day to the next better. So for those who in the public intellectual space, the, you know, we all universally agree that books are a very good way to learn a new topic. I mean, of course, the inner machinations are a whole different story, but in general, like there are very good summaries or there are very good ways to dive into a field or go deeper into a field rather. But to what extent can we safely ask ourselves, have I done enough? Am I smart enough to embark on a project related to this field? Am I knowledgeable enough that I am okay with just putting this field aside and I can bring it up in conversation? I don't know. So I need an objective way to measure it. So I think that that sort of starts to relate to our current culture in wanting to ascertain how much we have grown, as opposed to the fulfillment of wanting to actually embrace the wisdom that is contained within these works, such as The Art of War, even if they have a certain narrative, even if they have a certain context, like, for example, war. Like, we're not in war right now. Like, we don't have a world war where we can actually apply these things. Like, the both of us aren't Sun Tzu, right? So we're not actually applying these army tactics. But it does bring up that point of, I want to package these wisdoms, and now I have access to these wisdoms everywhere in current modern times. How much of these wisdoms can I take into myself, or can I expose myself to, hence speed reading through them, to catch up with the busy pace of the world, is one thought I've had recently. And that translates well to a Rome graph, which can capture all of this chaos, but how much of it is actually useful is another thing. But before I dive into that super ultra tangent, why a study guide? And the reason why I'm asking that is because even if you try to deconstruct The Hero of a Thousand Faces, I can think of a few ways where you can do that without the format of a study guide, right? It could be either a podcast or conversation or an audio journal, what I've learned, a blog post a week. But what's your fascination with the format of the study guide?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think that, I reserve the right at some point to write an essay or do a podcast or something like that, saying, hey, this is what I've learned. But I think that the initial impetus was to provide people with their own set of tools to have their own experience of the book. And I think that a study guide, in my definition, or at least the way that I think of it, I think of it as any supplemental material that gives the reader additional perspectives or handholds to get purchase on a difficult piece of reading material. So I think that you could come up with a list of 100 questions and put that in a pamphlet and just shoot it over to me. And if you said this is The Hero with a Thousand Faces study guide, and it was just like 100 really, really thoughtful, interesting questions that cast the material into different lights and contexts, I would consider that a totally acceptable and very, very useful study guide. Short answer is that I want to preserve people's ability to have their own experience of the text while giving them alternative tools to hammer at it, to like have insights, to sort of make realizations based on it.
Right. So it is not a replacement for the book, but rather a complement to one's reading experience.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Okay. 100%.
Okay.
Your observations beforehand, and I don't know if this is too tangential to jump back to it, but you know, what I heard you asking, at least translated into my language, is probably the most important question, which is, how do you know? Okay. Assume it, like, yes, we as human beings have this desire to quantify because it's an easy way, like quantify the amount of books we've read or the amount of reps we've done, because it's an easy way to say that we've made progress. And this is because progress in itself is a very hard thing to measure, and it frustrates the crap out of us, especially considering that we put a lot of effort into things and it's not linear, and we have short-term yep. thinking, and it's hard to see progress over a long term. So what I hear you asking or musing about is, like, how do you know when a book or a piece of material has actually changed your life? Like, how do you know when it's done the job, or at least the job as I have defined it? And to that, I would say that that's a really good question, and I have no idea. But that's why I wrote the study guide, is basically to say, look, I don't think that finishing the book is enough. I think that producing an additional creative work or my own sort of capstone project based on the book would give me the satisfaction. Would give me greater satisfaction and also lead me to believe that I have used this book or understood its lessons in a way that has come closer to changing my life. And I would say that my experience of it is that it absolutely has. I mean, I've resonated with this material far more deeply than I did on my first sort of passive read, and it has imparted upon me certain pieces of knowledge or certain perspectives that I now hold very, very dear to me. And it would not have happened had I not gone the extra step from just reading a book to, like, actually trying to do something with that book. And I think that's the bottom line of my approach to reading is, like, don't read it, do something with it.
You're onto something there with the passive reading and the gradual embracing of what you've learned from this book or from any particular book in question, because I think it's our reading philosophies that allow us to actually gain so much more, even if we're not quantifying or, you know, measuring the number of books that we have read in a year. Like, oh, 52 means I'm 52 books smarter than I was last year. But are you really, right? Yeah. Are you just memorizing all 52 books, or are you actually applying these? On that thought, though, I sort of came to, like, a half answer, but I still need to prove it. And when we say progress is a hard thing to measure and that quantifying is a lot easier, there are two parts to that, at least for me. One is there's a certain fear. There's a certain fear behind, why am I reading this book and how am I applying it? Because that's very hard to answer already. Like, I think you could totally tell me that I'm wrong, but maybe in your very first reading of Hero of a Thousand Faces, the first time that you went through the book, it might have been very, very life-changing already, or because it was passive, there may not have been that many moments where you could actually apply what you've learned. Or
I had no idea what I was reading.
Exactly. Okay, right. Okay, there we go. So there's a certain fear behind actually confronting that, right? So maybe it was a mandatory reading. Maybe you heard the book name so many times that you thought, oh, everybody else is reading it, why not I read it as well, right? So it's a little bit of FOMO here and there. So there's a bit of fear behind actually wanting to apply what I've just read on page 55 to 57. What can I use right now that can make the use of these words that I have just experienced 15 minutes ago, right? That's very, very difficult, right? You have to have the habit of wanting to apply these all the time. The second one is that it is easier to quantify the number of books we have read because it is harder to create greater quality of questions. I think that's where the source or where the answer can truly be, because even before we read a book, we're already asking questions. Like, why is this book so interesting? Why am I obsessed with mythology? Why is Joseph Campbell so great? What's so great about his works? I'm already building this preset of questions, essentially my own mental study guide, right? It's like version one of my study guide. And I read through this experience, this whole book, and instead of the experience being one and done, like, I'm done with the book, therefore I'm done with the study guide, it's more like, I have gone through this experience, I've gone through this book, and I have refined, I have tempered the study guide in my head so that when I read through it again, I can look at it from a different angle or with a clearer angle and find deeper, greater things. And I really like that what you're doing right now with your study guide is like an accelerator of that experience happening, like in our heads. Since
I think,
oh yeah, yeah, please.
Oh, pardon me. I was just going to say, it makes me very happy to hear you say that, because I think that you've nailed it on the head, or at least your thinking and my thinking is quite aligned in that. I think that, yes, we do start with our preconceived questions. I think that you're correct. The most difficult part of reading any material is actually, in my opinion, getting clear about what exactly confuses you.
Yeah,
I think that if you pay attention to your moment-to-moment experience of being confused, I think the most, at least for me, the most helpless and the most frustrating form of confusion is this vague, amorphous confusion where the words are just not making sense. But for the life of you, if somebody stopped you, put a gun to your head and said, what is confusing you right now? You would not be able to say what it is. And yeah. I think that that's really, for me, absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. You know, this was the study guide's purpose for me, was to take my preconceived notions about what I was going to expect or what questions this book would answer for me, and then reconcile them with the questions that the book actually did arise in my head, and then start to get straight about, like, okay, what fundamentally is preventing me from understanding this material? And I can give you a couple of examples that came up. You know, one, and I think you'll see in my study guide, I base it around a series of questions that sort of pop up for me. And then I sort of write like mini essays on those questions. And one of the biggest questions that came up for me is, in what sense can we say a story is true? And the reason that this came up is because, all right, so this sort of gets into the weeds. Are we down to do that?
Yeah, let's go for it. Let's go it.
All right, cool. So like, look, I already said, you know, in the most practical sense, you can think of a story as a really efficient, sticky, mimetic way to share information that's important, right? But then Campbell goes further and says, but hey, you got to realize that the characters, the figures that we put into those stories, they come from our imagination, and that actually comes from our deep unconsciousness. And so these stories are not just the records of practical teachings. They are also have this component where they are the records of human beings dealing with psychological challenges that get manifested via these symbolic characters that reappear and appear in our stories. And so, you know, a story like the Iliad does not only have like a physical, it does not only refer to a physical achievement, but it also refers to certain psychological trials and tribulations that every person has to go through. So here now we have a practical truth to the story, and we have a psychological truth to the story, which is made manifest by the fact that these symbols come from our imagination, and that they're spontaneously generated, and they're the same symbols of our dreams, and that there's that link between our psychological challenges and the characters that creatives create in these stories. Okay, cool. I get you. I'm okay with that. But then there's this further question about the metaphysical truth of stories. And this is where like my brain just went absolutely kaput. And this is why I ended up doing the study guide, because I could not grasp this for the life of me. So basically, if I can sum up the question, it goes something like this. It's not enough to say that these stories have psychological truths. I mean, it's true, but it's not enough, because all across the world, uncoordinated, spontaneously, different societies that never touched each other, never influenced each other, have all come up with these very, very similar tales that deal with the creation and the dissolution of the universe, literally how something came out of nothing. And we, those are reflected in our biblical myths. They're reflected in our fairy tales. They are the center or at the core of every single story are these themes about this beginning and ending of the universe. And so Campbell says, it's not enough to read stories as psychology. You also have to respect the fact that for as long as humanity has had the oral or written tradition, our wise people have purposefully and independently used stories to try to communicate or try to wonder or try to think out loud about what it meant for us to be existing and how did something come of nothing. And so this kind of boggled my mind for a long time because I couldn't figure out what my problem was. And until I did this study guide and realized, well, the question that I'm trying to ask is, well, what does it mean for a story to be true? Like, okay, so what? So what? We've all spontaneously come to these metaphysical assumptions about the world. Like, what does that mean? Like, does that actually map onto reality? Or is that just a common faulty piece of biological hardware that every single human being carries that makes them spontaneously come up with this myth? And my answer to that is I still do not know, but that even though I can't say for sure what that answer is, reading and going through the study guide process has sort of made me realize or come to the conclusion that the truth of the story actually isn't as important as I thought it was. The fact is that Campbell is simply an archaeologist of some of the most profound beliefs that humanity has shared. And like those metaphysical beliefs have influenced everything about our lives, from our sense of ethics to our sense of like, to how we organize society, to how we think about the afterlife. So in a sense, if I'm just obsessed with asking about the empirical reality of it, I'm sort of missing the point.
Right.
The point is that we run by this code one way or another. But anyway, that's a really, really long and sort of tangential in the weeds topic to just basically say that it took me reading that book 3 times, writing countless essays, countless sort of musings, like waking up every single day early in the morning to like write in my public wiki and do all that to realize, okay, this is what my issue has been with the book for the entire time. And that has given me a real sense of not only accomplishment, like faith in myself that I can diligently work at a problem and come to a satisfactory solution, even if it eludes me, but also a different perspective on maybe that there are things that are true that are not necessarily empirically sound. So, yeah.
Wow, this is... That's a heavy journey that you went on to do that. As reading the book 3 times to realize this, maybe it's picking at it or mining at what lies deeper than the current observational truth that Campbell has realized and imprinted into the book, that are like the obsession with that activity may make one miss the point. And I can see that, right? I can see myself going down that path as well. Because we can always read the book explicitly and read the book implicitly, where explicitly is just what is written in the book and then that's it. Implicitly is when you impose or you introduce your context or your own what I call internal society. So like the society within self, you know, the culmination of all your principles, values, your experiences growing up, and the questions that you hold dear the most, where you would always apply these to everything that you observe. And you put that into this book and you think, what are the conflicts? What are the clashes, right? Like, that's why we do a lot of pre-reading where we try to try to bring up the questions that we want to ask ourselves as we are reading these books and see where our answers are right or wrong, so that we can learn and deconstruct the borders between this new piece of information and then embrace that and put that in. I feel like I can see like the excitement when you've realized this on your third time reading this, because it might have been, it's probably such a life-changing moment that you would put the book up like on an altar and worship it, since it feels like unlocking answers to the universe, right? Like Campbell is so far ahead that he wrote this entirely dense book where the point of the book will only be realized by those who have read it over and over again, deconstructed, created a study guide around it, played with it, cried over it, read over it, was confused over it, yet still tried to beat that confusion. And therefore you have the answers. Feels like an adventure in itself, which is quite ironic since it's a book about mythology and
oh, all of this is cyclical. Like every, like it's so meta, it hurts my brain, man.
Yeah, I would love to go through that experience. I think I've only felt that maybe once or twice with books or experiences. At least in the realm of books, maybe one or two. Like my
you
favorite.
Remember which ones?
Yeah, the first one was Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Quartet, or like this Earthsea series is my favorite series mm-hmm. ever. More than Lord of the Rings. So whoever is a Lord of the Rings fan will probably hang me for that. But I grew up with Earthsea, and mm-hmm. it's not even a deep book. It's just like a very simple adventure book. But I've read it 3-4 times, and I still have my copy from when I was 10 or 11 years old. So there's this, if we take that example, I'm already putting my implicit internal society into that book.
Yeah.
And I read that book with absolutely no questions. I'll give you the reason why I bought that book. The cover was pretty. That's actually just it. Like, there was a dragon. There was a dragon on the picture on the book. I was like, cool. And I bought it, right? And it turns out to be like 1,200 pages because it's 4 books in one book. Anyway, I read it the first time and I was like, oh, that was pretty cool. And then I read it the second time when I was older. And then I read it the third time last year. Yeah, last year. So what's more interesting than having your implicit internal societies that have grown over decades to read the exact experience and realize the differences between your own internal study guide for the same book over and over again? It's crazy. It is crazy. And it's something that, like, I honestly really respect you for being able to even articulate all of that. Like, that's insane. Because if you ask me, like, oh, what's the most, you know, profound, impactful thing you've read, you've gained from Earthsea, I can't tell you, right? I can't give you an answer. I can only express through joy and laughter and maybe even dancing, but I can't articulate it. I can't put it into language. That's difficult. And I think for our questions or for our answers, etc., we can't put it into language until we have played with the book over and over again. So, yeah.
it's curious though, because I don't think that I have actually had a very similar experience, and just recently as well. So I am I'm Trinidadian. I'm originally from Trinidad and Tobago, a small island, bottom of the Caribbean, and one of the books that I grew up with is a collection of short stories by our, the one Nobel Prize winning for literature author, V.S. Naipaul. And it's called Miguel Street. And it is about it's a collection of short stories that capture the zeitgeist is not the word. Umwelt is maybe the word of just the smell and the feel and the people of a specific time, you know, post-World War, Trinidad and Tobago. It's a very special place and a very unique place. And I read that book growing up. And I recently started reading the short stories out loud to my wife before bed, because I picked up the book and I just thought, oh, this is crazy. This is this. Let me reread this. I remember it fondly. And man, I couldn't stop crying. That book is so much profound, like profundity in small moments, and so much sadness, and like such the dry laugh of what does Campbell say, like the dry hard laugh of the Olympian who knows that life and death is part of an unremitting circle that never ends, who sees tragedy and laughs at it, you know, like this is this was. So I just say that to say that, like, yeah, absolutely, like having your own internal society meet your old internal society is just it's a crazy experience. And I love your phrasing, like internal society, like that is the best way to put it. It's an incredible experience, and I don't think that I could put it into words. Although I think Campbell has given me, like Hero with a Thousand Faces, Campbell has given me some words that I'll plagiarize. And I think that for me, I don't know what it was like for you, but it had a lot to do with the sadness of the recognition of a time past that is never recoverable, but also the optimism that said time that is never recoverable has died and we're still here. And that this is the process of the world. And to just bring it back to Hero with a Thousand Faces, you know, it's funny. You read that book over and over and over and over again. And at the end, the punchline is the same as when you started. And that is that all things exist through a cycle of life and death, an unremitting life and death. We are born from nothingness. We go back into nothingness, but our own deaths are only an illusion caused by the limited nature of having a self-centered ego. And if we could step back and observe things from the perspective of undefeatable life, we would realize that all of life is a comedy, even in its most tragic states. And you read those words the first time and you go, huh, cool. And you read them the second time and you go, okay, I'm a little more confused, but huh, cool. And then you read them the third time and suddenly it sort of clicks because you've just been meditating on these things. And I think I would wrap this sort of rant up by saying, you know, one thing that it really reinforces in me is that there is a difference between received truths and things that are the experience of phenomena. And if you have any experience with meditation, you'll be able to 100% like agree with that, because somebody can describe to you the feeling of selflessness, but dude, until you've touched it, it's the reason that the Buddha, like the paintings of the Buddha, have one hand pointing at the ground. It's you can only be shown the way, but you can't be taught enlightenment. You can only show the way, and you have to walk it yourself.
Yeah, it's true, and I honestly do agree. It's that, and we can see that translated even in current examples where we have those who share their traumas or those who share their stories, and we can listen in admiration, but we can never truly feel or sense or gain the same emotions just from them telling it. We must walk that path ourselves to fully understand why they have gone through the following, right? I like that phrasing, actually, experience of phenomena. I think of it as being able to sit with my silence, who is my friend, because there's nothing scarier than sitting down and being able to hear the voice that dwells in one's silence. It's insane.
Oh, you mean the one that I suffocate on a daily basis while I do other things?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That one's like, scary.
Yeah. It's like that little parasite, that is hinting at you while you're going about your day. And then you try to avoid it by making yourself busy. You never know, right? Like, oh, you know, how many books will you read before you can get rid of that voice? I don't know.
But then maybe you'd like Campbell, because, you know, this is all part of the hero, the concept behind the hero with a thousand faces. Like, look, I know we jumped straight into the metaphysical deep end, but basically it starts like this. It starts with the recognition that, look, you've got your conscious reality and all of the things that you busy yourself with, right? But every so often, that conscious reality lies on top of this massive unconsciousness, right? And every so often, something creeps up from the unconscious world and scares the ever-living crap out of you. Yeah. And it's fascinating. It's horrifying. And what Campbell says is that it is itself the promise of everything that you could ever desire, your fulfillment, maybe not everything that you could ever desire. Rather, it's the promise of living a fulfilled, united life in integrated consciousness with unconsciousness. But it's also balanced against the perils of disintegration, because, you know, from the unconscious comes all of this dark material that we don't identify with, the thing that Jung called the shadow. And so I guess why I bring this up is because it's funny that we talk about this, because, you know, this is the basis for the hero's tale. What Campbell says is that, like, look, when you think about Hercules, when you think about Riding Hood, when you think about any of these heroic tales, they are describing physical achievements, but those physical achievements are metaphors and symbols for the psychological achievements that all of us have to go out and accomplish in order to expand our consciousness.
Right.
And I think that it's very, very helpful to think about mythology in that way. And it also reminds us that, like, whatever you want to accomplish in your life, your physical victory must be preceded with a psychological victory. And that's a little truism that is so important and so easy to forget.
I feel like I've learned that. And I'm forgetting it. Like, I need to be reminded of that a lot. Which is where these tales can come in. And as much as they follow the same structures, as much as they follow the same principles or frameworks that we see in many different epics throughout history, that just shows how important these things are, because they are seen in so many different cultures all around the world. We have anecdotes and stories only told orally, at least from where I am. I come from an indigenous tribe in Borneo, and there are only some stories that are not, you know, they're not on a wiki page or anything, or they're not like on a book or archived in a museum or a library. There are stories that only my family would tell me, like about legendary warriors or about our ancestors and what they've done. And so, of course there's the pride of, okay, you are of the blood of this one warrior. You should try to embrace these stories in. But then I remember when I was young, I remember when my dad, or at least actually my grandfather, was the one telling me these. He didn't really have to narrate it in a way where I have to sense or feel what happened back then to tell me about our family. So there's a very big distinction there, because you can always just say, oh yeah, you are of the blood of this one legendary warrior. He did the following, and then that's it. Right. Mm-hmm. But the way that he told it was that it was more of Umwelt, which is what you just mentioned just now. And I just looked it up, which is pretty interesting. So I will definitely use my roam to actually find out more about Umwelt. He had to run me through all of the experiences that the warrior had gone through in order to give me an idea of what the received truth can be, so that my conscious reality can at least pay attention to it. I don't know if like, I don't know if I fully embraced it like subconsciously. I can never tell, because there's no way we can ever tell, because it's subconscious, right? Like, it's kind of difficult. It's only when it surfaces up at the right moment, then it'll be applicable. So highly unlikely I'll become a tribal warrior and fight against the government. I don't know. But but running me through the experiences and allowing me the chance to pay attention to an observed part of human history, so that my conscious reality can hopefully be altered, or hopefully can change shape to allow that to happen, is quite a fascinating experience. And I think that's probably why Campbell was obsessed with that, because it's very, very universal. And when it's very, very universal, it is only universal when there's a pattern, and he has noticed the pattern, and that is why we came to this book. And now here's the question. If we have Rome, and you are given the chance to expand on these patterns, these opportunities where we can allow our conscious reality to experience a tale and relive it over and over again until we can shape our character or shape our internal society to accept what the true value is in there. Is there any aspect of mythology that you want to explore now that you have Rome, the tool?
Yeah, actually. So I think that you've probably seen this in other places, but I don't care. I think that it would be interesting to do, especially alongside an analysis of the hero with 1,000 faces and also a reading. But let's back up a bit and say what Campbell did is that Campbell created a generic formula by which you could analyze and recognize the different components of mythology across the world. So he basically, he took all of the myths, put them side by side, made a big circle, and he was like, dude, it just starts with departure, moves to initiation, and then it's to return. And then there's these common themes that happen along that path and these different variations on the story. But you can take any mythology story from anywhere in the world and you can find this framework. And that's why somebody like George Lucas was able to read Hero with 1,000 Faces and say, oh, I'm gonna go write Star Wars now, because I've got a general framework for writing stories. So I think that one thing that would be really interesting to do with Rome is, and I think also maybe like the internationalization of your internal society, to take some of these themes or these motifs that come up in different stories. So like, let's say there's this one motif called the refusal of the call. And so it basically happens at the beginning of the adventure. The hero will be receive some sort of unambiguous or slightly a little more ambiguous sign that things are changing, and it's time to go on an adventure. And in modern screenwriting, we would call that an inciting act. It's like the thing that happens that starts the story. And so there's this motif that happens, or this theme in many stories or many myths, where the hero will try to refuse the call, will try to say, oh, no, that's not for me. And, you know, without getting too deep into it, there are some really interesting analyses of that. The refusal of the call sort of symbolizes mankind's inability to conceive of the grand timescale of life, because when you refuse the call, you're basically like a child holding on to your current like possessions, basically being like, I don't want change. Like,
right.
This change is scary, but that's that it represents a misunderstanding of how life works, because all of life is perpetuated by a series of deaths and rebirths, even if you think about generations, et cetera, et cetera. So to refuse change is, you know, just a senseless endeavor, and it never ends well for the person who refuses the call. Anyway, long story short, I think it would be really interesting to say, okay, here's a little bit, a blurb on the refusal of the call. Here are the themes that show up. Now, here are 50 different myths that are all public domain from like a bunch of different cultures where the call is refused. And I want you to search through them, read all those different myths, and start to realize like, hey, dude, like as much as we really key on focusing on the differences and fetishizing the differences between societies, like our common humanity is such that we deal with the same practical concerns, we deal with the same psychological concerns, and we deal with the same metaphysical concerns about like what this is and how is and how is am and how is are, like whatever, like how this all came to be. And so I think Rome would be great for that, you know, set up the motif, explain it, and then start to link to different, you know, different instantiations of that motif so that a person can see it played out in different cultures and get an appreciation both for our difference but also our great sameness.
Wow, that is a great endeavor, and I really want to see that happen. Like, I really, really want to see that happen. I'm trying to visualize it. I'm trying to imagine the architecture, and it's not.
You just hashtag like. I guess create up keyword refusal of the call. Just hashtag it in the metadata, and then if you key on refusal of the call, or maybe you could filter. So I guess what you do is you go. Motifs being the page, then filter by refusal of the call, or filter by the goddess mother, or filter by like crucifixion. Like these are all motifs that show up time and time again. And maybe there'd be a head page for each motif that would give you the lay of the land for. This might be a little bit inside baseball, but it is Rome FM. So I suppose everybody's cool with me pontificating out loud, but yeah, maybe there's a head page in the beginning, and then you could collect all of the stories that you just import from Britannica or wherever is open source, probably not Britannica actually, but wherever you can, you collect them, and maybe they would be collect in the unlinked references or the linked references somewhere below. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm imagining it like that. Like, okay, we have motive as a page. You have its global blocks explaining what it is. Then you have all the references being the, yeah, it's probably like a metadata or a meta tag at the end of certain sections of a text. So that means that you have to import the mythologies in, mm-hmm. and you have to make sure that the writing is consistent. It should be okay as long as you reference the source so you can clean it up later. I was thinking where to put queries in, but I think queries are when you can have special pages, which are discussions. So let's say that you have a public graph and you have, let's say, 10 historians on mythologies, right? They want to talk about the differences between, say, how is refusal of a call depicted in different continents? So you want to query by location, you want to query by mythology, by country, etc. And then you have, going back to what we were talking about before, a little bit of multiplayer, people are commenting, people are block refing specific sections or actually highlighting certain words to show that, okay, a refusal happened in this kind of situation in, say, India, in Indian mythology. This is what happened. However, there are differences between here and in Russian mythology where the following happened. Why? And you can figure out why. Even though, yeah. empirically speaking, a lot of the observations or a lot of the universal emotions are the same. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. they are represented may be different, which has in itself, as much as the primary advantage is that we have a greater understanding of mythologies and how they're shown. For me personally, it feels like it's a greater way to unite the world because it reduces the borders between who we are as nationalities and as cultures, and it shows more of who we are as human beings. And what Campbell is showing with his formula, as much as you can call it a general formula, it's a lot more impactful than a general formula. It's more like a way to look at civilization from the angle of time since all cycles must have an axis of time before mm-hmm. rebirth and reincarnation can occur. How is that the minute differences between that represents the different societies rather all around the world, the different countries? Yeah, I would love to see a graph on that. I mean, if we can get an aggregation of that, like I would love to like, you know, knock on doors in universities and be like, hey, I'm building a mythology graph, or like, hey, Sam's building a mythology graph.
Yeah.
Can you show yours? Like one from every country would be amazing. That'd be pretty cool.
I mean, it would be awesome. A few things come to mind. You know, the stories are so clever and so entertaining. There's this story, I'm going to butcher this, but the Japanese mythology, I believe, story of Amaterasu, believe sun goddess. I am so going out on a limb by like trying to recall this from memory on a podcast, but sun goddess. And at some point, she basically gets fed up with the world and locks herself into a door or into her chamber. And the rest of the goddesses and the gods conspire to bring the sun back out again, without which the world would wilt. And so they do so by getting a giant mirror god, literally reflective mirror, to stand in front of the door, right? and then basically they start having a party, and the sun goddess is like, yo, what the hell? Like, how are you guys partying? You should be miserable. There's no sun. And one of the gods that are tricking her, you know, replies, oh no, it's great. We found somebody who's even brighter than you. This is awesome. And so she peeks out the door, looks at the mirror, sees her own reflection, and is basically tricked, like, oh, they've replaced me, steps out. And then they cast a piece of string like behind her, so she can't step back through the door. I mean, these myths are just, they're hilarious, but like, and they're so clever and so inventive, but they also have these profound things to say about like how we come to terms with, you know, having finite life, and how we come to terms with, you know, the inevitable losses that we will all have to sustain. And I think that there is something incredibly valuable about looking at your fellow human being through the lens of story, because it really does highlight what you share. Even if sometimes the differences in how the stories are told from culture to culture are absolutely fascinating, you know, just off of my top of my head, I believe it's the Zoroastrians. Normally, like whenever you've got the figure of the cosmic god, it's usually a man, but the Zoroastrians have the cosmic woman, who in her depictions and paintings is just this radiant sort of like ethereal figure. And it's interesting to speculate on how like a change like that filters down into the culture, or whether it does or doesn't, you know. Anyway, these are all interesting sort of tangents. And that is to say that I think there would be a great benefit in a mythology graph. But of course, one would have to ask, in what way is that different from Wikipedia? Which is, I don't know what the answer is.
I think you can probably ponder on that, actually, because a Wikipedia is first of all, Wikipedia, massive respect, like they're amazing people. But a Wikipedia is a resource hub, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that's it, right? Like that's pretty much it. You can rebuild. Like, I mean, I don't want to make any bold claims because I'm not part of the Rome research team, but you can, if you can export all the info out of Wikipedia, you can put it into Rome, and it would look the same. Like it would look the same. It would function more or less the same. You can link between pages, etc., and all the text can work, and you can put images, etc. That can pretty much work. I think what Rome can do a little bit differently, at least within the realm of mythology, if you can have like mankind mythology public graph, which just my mind would be so blown. Oh, that'd be so cool. Would be the discussions. I think that's when it will be very, very fascinating. Like, yeah, you have a neutral team to upload, import, and clean and clarify all the text and histories of different cultures, the different cultures rather, and put it in there. And then you have the curators, the commenters, the ones who find or mine for more questions or more prompts, and then they share their thoughts all within the same graph. And mm-hmm. you start to build not only a resource hub of mythology, but a time stream of human interaction with the mythology, which yeah, is where yeah. you can find deeper meaning between these. Because sometimes anecdotes, especially oral ones, they're not as detailed, mainly due to the course of time. They reduce in details to keep it much more memorable or easier to pass down to the next generation. Or there mm-hmm. are some historical inaccuracies, right? Which can happen. You can't help it, right? Like, we're dealing with like thousands of years of human history. It's kind of difficult mm-hmm. to keep everything accurate unless you have a Rome graph from when the Roman Empire was still alive and well. Like, I mean, it would yeah. be pretty cool. But I think one potential avenue to expand upon just a resource hub of mythology would be a forum for people to talk about and discuss and ponder on mythologies and have that synchronized with the resource hub for mythologies.
Yeah.
Because yeah, how likely is it that you have comments on a Wikipedia page? I don't really check.
Yeah. I know that there is a robust discussion section, but I think that for good, because of the desire of the company or the organization, sorry, to be seen as a neutral purveyor of information, I think that, as to my understanding, and I myself have not participated, but I did actually just listen to a podcast with the founder. My understanding is that there are tight constraints on how those conversations are had and who can put and sort of
right.
in what way can you participate in those conversations. And the product of those participations, those conversations, make it to the front page of Wikipedia or the actual articles themselves. I think what is more interesting in a Rome framework, at least top of mind, is not only can we have our mythology graph, but you know, other people can have sort of their own graphs linking to the mythology graph, and you can seamlessly move within the Romosphere between different graphs, and those different graphs can sort of basically have different slants and different tilts depending on what the native rules are for those graphs, right? Like almost like every right. graph can be its own community with its own sort of like, okay, this graph we're it's only for stating information, there's only one person who edits it, but like this graph we just discuss, it's a free for all, like just, and you know, like this is okay. sort of one thing yeah. one where it does sort of become like almost like a information forum as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's becoming a network then. Like it's like yeah. multiple graphs, and the resultant interactions between these following graphs is humanity's mythology in a nutshell.
Quite possibly. Yeah. Although this is, as they say, beyond my pay grade. So. Yeah.
It's things like this that make me so excited for hypergraphic like features, like linking blocks from other people's graphs. Like I can't mm-hmm. wait. Like I'm gonna be very honest, I can't wait for the day where I can block ref your study guide into my graph as I'm reading through Hero of a Thousand Faces, and like if we do like an imaginary interaction. Let's say I'm on like chapter 7 and then I have a comment on one of the things that you wrote. I would block ref the thing that you wrote into my graph, nest under there a block where I have some comments, and I message you, say, hey, I have some comments, here's my block ref, and I send it to you, and then you just copy paste to your graph and boom, you have my private comments to you about it or my notes on it, which would be pretty awesome, so that it becomes this cycle, as we mm-hmm. like to bring it up in this conversation many times, a cycle of conversations where we can keep the conversation going or keep the story going for that specific block or that specific mythology. So it's a beautiful framework that can be universally applied to anything. I like the framework mainly because beyond tales, beyond myths, it makes sense to see a beginning and end for a narrative. Like even if there are no characters, because even if there are no characters, even if we are just explaining different experiences within that narrative, we are going to somehow subconsciously, especially from what we just talked about just now, put ourselves as characters within those narratives, mainly because there has to be psychological wins and achievements that we have to embrace in order to understand that narrative. So having that synchronized with Rome features would be amazing. I cannot wait for that.
I'm actually, as you're, you know, these may be low quality thoughts because I've never really actually thought about this before, but I'm now wondering, like, you know, if we had sort of a mythology graph, I just wonder how that would impact my personal journaling, whether I'd be able to pick up on certain themes, whether it's dream journaling or just personal journaling, and go, hey, oh, I dreamt about X, Y, and Z. Let me just scan the mythology graph and see if there's anything interesting going on. And there, I know that we dangerously wade into armchair psychoanalyst territory. And that's, I'm not claiming that one can do that sort of work. I'm wildly unqualified to say that, but I do think that there is some, you know, it's just an interesting synergies between our own freeform thinking and being able to link that out to established canonical texts or established canonical myths and just go, hey, oh, that's cool. That's an interesting comparison. Or where did that show up? I think that's very Rome.
Yeah, our willingness to link these would really help. And actually, I'm already doing that, technically, with my freeform journaling. Rather than canonical text, it would be past text or blocks that I've done before. I'm not sure what other set of questions that you would have in your head when you would freeform write in Rome. But for me, when I write in Rome and I'm thinking about something, sometimes as I'm writing out the block, it will trigger a past block that I somehow vaguely remember. And I'll try my best to surface it up as much as possible. And then nest the block ref underneath the block I was writing. And then nesting that block ref, I would write or try to explain my rationale as to why did I remember this?
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm going to have to see that because that's really interesting, but I'm having a hard time visualizing it.
Okay.
It's at some point, like I'd love to see that. Because I think if anything that can get your journal, your freeform journal to be more contiguous with your past entries, I think that that's an absolute win, especially for people who do a lot of thinking. I think that one realizes just how profoundly your feelings and moods change from day to day, and then how little they change from month to month to year to year, and how, like, you know, like daily it looks like you're all over the place, but like over a longer period of months and years, these cycles sort of emerge and you realize, oh, these are the limitations of having a brain that can't remember what I had for lunch last week, Tuesday.
You brought it up actually, but wouldn't it be cool to find out a way to visualize the cycles in one's Rome graph? Like if you could track like potential. Anyway, now I might be imposing the framework too much there, though that is probably a topic for another time. So we are coming up on time, Sam, although I'm sure that we could rock for like another 4 hours or something on that.
I am very good at burning time talking about this kind of stuff. If there's one talent I can lay claim to, I'll take that one. And you've been an awesome conversation partner. I really thank you for inviting me on and asking me to talk about the stuff that matters most to me. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's a good way to make friends. And I really, thank you.
Yeah. And I'm sure for anyone who is listening to this right now will surely take their time. And I highly recommend taking your time listening to this episode because it's very dense, metaphysical, very absolute, down to the most empirical truth. So if you take your time, you know, writing down what we say, and maybe even write your own study guide for this episode, because then it will be really, really useful. But might as well close it off with a couple of segments that I would like to end this episode, although we could probably talk for another episode another time. Sam, the first question is, how would you describe Rome to someone who hasn't started using it yet?
Okay. So if you are in business, I would say that it is Excel for ideas. If you are a musician, I would say, do you remember what a sampler is? Like, it's basically like a keyboard sampler for your best, for your greatest hits ideas. And if you are my parents, I would say, it's the thing that I spend 99% of my time on. I'm really sorry. I should probably do something else.
I spend 110% of my time in Rome, and I've been losing sleep over it. And
Norman, I'm just trying to work up to your KPIs. Like, one day I'll put those numbers up.
No one should aspire to reach up to my level of being in Rome all the time, especially when you have like multiple graphs and one of them is for this show, because I have a lot of ideas for this Rome FM graph and it's killing me trying to think of how to even embark upon it. But definitely something that I also spend a lot of my time on. And the final question is, what does Rome mean to you?
Do you mind if I take a second?
Go for it.
Rome is a companion. It's a way to have a dialogue with past, present, and future selves of myself, or instantiations of myself. And I think for that, it's, you know, irreplaceable. So, yeah.
Irreplaceable. Indeed, a way for you to talk with your past and future selves, just as we would going from the end of Hero of a Thousand Faces. We start in the beginning all over again. Sam, thank you so much. If we want to talk to you or contact you to discuss anything that we talked about in this conversation, what is the best way to do that?
You can find me at Twitter at Sam Learns. And there you will find musings about storytelling, basically building things, whether that be businesses or stories or mythology. I mean, all of this comes from a desire to play with ideas, see how they work, see when they break. I used to have it up on my bio, but I will repeat it now. You know, I am the dangerous idiot who thinks that ideas are not abstract, but they're much more fun when you actually can use them. And so if that's what you're into, say hi. I'm always down to have a conversation.
Awesome. And of course, links to Sam's Twitter will be in the show notes right below if you want to have this amazing conversation, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. For anyone who is interested in workflows, etc., I'm really sorry I didn't really get into the workflows part, but this was so fascinating that I cannot help but ask so many questions on it, because Campbell's work is amazing and I really applaud you for being able to create a study guide for one of the greatest works of all time. So Sam, thank you so much, and I will see you on Twitter.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. Make sure to hit subscribe in your favorite podcast listening app. And for a full version of the show notes to this episode, you can check out the public Rome graph. The link to that will be in the description right below. For more updates, comments, feedback, and suggestions, you can reach out to me at RomeFM on Twitter. Keep roaming your thoughts, and I will see you in the next episode. Take care.